was born in Vienna, but my father was born in Vienna in Smoland in 1865. When he was 4 years old, his folks came to America.
In
1870. Yeah. And lived in Rockford, Illinois. So he grew up there. And grandmother's name was Martha, but I've forgotten her maiden name. I got a record somewhere.
How big of a family was it? How big of a family?
Oh, there was three brothers and three sisters, I think. Because I had Uncle John and Uncle Charlie and Aunt Ida and Aunt Mary and Aunt Emma. So, and they all lived in Rockford. And they, my father, he said, grew up there, but he went to Augustana College and got his degree there. And then went on into the seminary. But between the college and seminary, he was at Gustavus Adolphus College and taught there for 2 years up in St. Peter, Minnesota. And then he was out in Connecticut and started to work on his doctor's degree at Yale University. He got his master's degree at Augustana about 18. So he graduated from Augustana College in 89, and I guess about 93 he got his master's degree. But instead of completing his doctor's degree, he went back to seminary. But in the meantime, he came to Jamestown, New York, and spent 2 summers at Chautauqua Institution and studied Hebrew and church history and theology for 2 whole summers. I have a Hebrew Bible downstairs that says N.E. Crone, Chautauqua, New York, 1891. And so he spent the 2 summers there, and when he went to seminary, they gave him a year's credit for that work he had done at Chautauqua. Then, between the 2 summers, he was a student pastor at First Lutheran Church here in Jamestown. And then, as I said, he went on to Yale and spent a year or two there. And but then, in 1895, he got married in South Manchester, Connecticut, to Esther Beekberry. And his first charge was in Harlem in New York City. And he was there a few years, and then he moved to Woburn, where I was born, and to Manchester, New Hampshire. And then we went out in 1907, we moved to Dayton, Iowa, and were there while I was in school. Then when I was in college, we lived in Galva, Illinois, which wasn't too far from Rock Island. And then after I finished college, I went out and taught languages at the Luther College in Wahoo, Nebraska. I taught Latin and German and Swedish. And I was there 3 years, and at that time the folks moved to Bertrand, Nebraska. And they were there until my father died in 1931. In 1926, after 3 years at Wahoo, I went down to Rock Island and attended the seminary, and after 2 years, I stayed out 1 year and served Bethel Church in Omaha, Nebraska. And during that time, my older brother, who was older than I am, but came in the seminary a year after I did, caught up with me, so we were both ordained together in 1930 in Rock Island, Illinois. And my father preached one of the sermons there at the ordination. I should also mention that something I was thinking of there in that connection, but it slipped my mind now. Because I could preach Swedish, I was called to churches in Connecticut, Norwich and Willimantic, Connecticut. And I served those two churches, and then was called to Waterbury, Connecticut, and served Waterbury, Thomaston, and Torrington churches. And it was a total of 20 years in Connecticut. As I said, I came there in 1930, and in 1935, I married Ingrid Andren, A-N-D-R-E-N, from Cranston, Rhode Island. And we had three daughters. And one now lives up near Rochester, New York, one in Olean, New York, and the other one out in Schaumburg, Illinois. And I have two of them are married and have six grandchildren. I guess that takes care of the family. In 1950, I was called to Olean, New York, and I served churches in Olean and Portville for 17 and a half years. And that's the longest I lived in one place in my whole life. Then I retired in 1968 and served on a part-time basis a church up in Silver Creek, New York, for 3.5 years. Then I retired a second time, moved to Jamestown. That was in 1971, so I've lived here now for 14 years. Three years ago in January, my wife was called home, and but I'm making out the best I can here under the circumstances. That might be a very brief biography, but I could tell more about the Vicbergs if you want to hear about them.
Ja. Det var ingressen, så att säga.
Ja.
Ja, jag sitter tillsammans med pastor Einar Kron i Jamestown, New York. Han var född 1900 den 1 december i Woburn, Massachusetts. Och det är idag den 10 september 1985. So if we go back a little bit, then, in other words, your father, he was very young when he came in 1870. He was only 4 years old.
Yes, that's right.
And his parents then, what did they work with in Sweden? Were they farmers? Or?
My grandfather worked in the furniture factory there in Rockford.
Yeah, and in Vienna, what were they doing there?
Mm-hmm.
In Vienna?
In Vienna, he was a farmer.
A farmer.
And he had a farm with another man. They had farmed together. I was there with the in Sweden in 1928 when the Augustana band went over there. The Augustana College band went over to Sweden, and I had a weekend where I went down and visited my father's. So I saw my father's homestead, which after Grandpa left there was not lived in, but became the a building for tools and a granary for the other man who had the farm with Grandpa. And that was a very interesting experience to come there and see that. And I still have a second cousin in Maryland by the name of Merstam, because he changed his name from Carlson to Merstam. Took Mer from Maryland. And I still correspond with him. He's a retired school teacher. And then on my mother's side, I have one second cousin living up near Yevle, who I correspond with occasionally, Ines Lundin. But going back to Grandpa Vicberg, he got the America fever when he was, even before he was married maybe, but when he got married, he tried to convince Grandma that they should move to America, but she was absolutely opposed. Hon sa då, om och om igen, jag är ingen förrädare, jag ska vara förrädare till min fosterland, jag ska stanna här i Sverige. And she kept on with that idea year after year.
And they were from Dalarna?
Yes, that's right. I should say that grandma was from Säter in Dalarna. And that's where they were married. And grandpa taught there for a while, and then he taught over in Gävle, over in Gästrikland, I guess it is. Yeah. And by the time they had five children, Mormor finally said, du vill gå till du vill resa till Amerika, så lämna. Och han gjorde. He went alone to America and came to New York City and got a job as a tailor. And while he was there, he went to Gustavus Adolphus Church, where Dr. Conrad Emil Lindbergh was the pastor. And Pastor Lindbergh found out he had done, that my grandfather had done some talks and preaching in the Missionsföreningar that they had over in Sweden then. In fact, Grandma and Grandpa were charter members of the Missionsförening in Säter. So he talked my grandfather into being a pastor, a lay pastor. And they sent him up to East Greenwich, Rhode Island. And he was there for 9 months and served this little church.
The Lutheran church there then?
Of Swedish people, yeah.
There was the first Lutheran church in Rhode Island? Greenwich.
In East Greenwich, yeah. No. And he was there 9 months, and then he was transferred to South Manchester, Connecticut. And he served there for 9 months and died at the age of 39, leaving six children and one born after he died. Now that's the Vicberg story.
So he came over here alone then?
Yeah. Oh, jag förglömde att nämna att efter han hade varit här ett år så köpte han biljetter for mormor, oh, fem born. So grandma came over a year later, about 1886, I guess it was, or 85, I don't remember now exactly. But anyhow, that's the, and they lived in New York City then for several years. At the time the Brooklyn Bridge was built, they were living there, and at the time the Statue of Liberty was being built, they were living there. So
he could make a living then on lay preaching?
Yes, after...
And it was for the Augustana then?
After he left New York City, yeah. But in New York City he worked as a tailor, yeah.
So when he was in Sweden and had this urging of going to America, do you think there was a religious feeling he had? In other words, he was a covenanter or a missionsvän in Sweden?
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't?
No. Well, they stayed Lutheran, but they went to missionsfriend meetings.
Well, they, how about, did he preach at the meetings?
Well, they asked him to preach. He had, I've got that in the story there, how he spent quite a time with this leader in the missionsförbund. I can't think of that name.
Waldenström?
What? Waldenström, yeah. And
did he have leanings towards the covenants?
Yes, he did, and towards the Methodists too. In one of his papers here, I found out somebody thought a lot of the Methodists.
So he was well read then about.
But he stayed Lutheran.
He did.
Yes, and went to, and served the Lutheran churches.
So Lindbergh saved them from going astray.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that when I was in the seminary at Rock Island, Illinois, Augustana Seminary, Dr. Conrad Emil Lindbergh was dean of the seminary at that time. So there were connections there.
So he was happy to see the offspring was coming his way.
Mm-hmm.
So why did he die so young though, 39 years old only?
He died of, why shouldn't I remember that? Because I mentioned so many times. If you could just hold it a little, died of a brain tumor, and they didn't know at that time just what it was, but they took an autopsy and found out what the reason was. Today, that no doubt would have been. Would have operated on it and been able to take care of it.
So then your grandma Wickberg was left alone?
Then she was left with six children and one born after he died. Two of them died as children, but the other five lived. And most of them stayed around New York City, although they lived in South Manchester, Connecticut. My father had his first charge in Harlem, in New York City.
There was the church on 125th or 29th?
Hmm?
It was on 129th or 25th?
Well, it was way down in the Harlem section.
Yeah.
But it moved later, farther north.
Oh, I see.
And merged with another church.
Uh-huh.
But if you look back in the early records, you'll find that there was a church right in Harlem. I can't remember the name of it now. But he served that, and he needed an organist, so he wrote to his sister-in-law, Aunt Ruth, up in Manchester, Ruth Wickberg, and asked her if she'd come down and be organist. So she did, and after she had been organist there for years, she got a job in a bigger church in Brooklyn, and she was an organist in that church for, I guess, 30 or 40 years after that. In the meantime, my mother's brothers moved down to Brooklyn. So finally, about 1903, I think it was, Grandma moved down there too. And they lived on 115 St. Mark's Place, which today I think is all Negroes.
In Brooklyn?
Right in Brooklyn, yep. Yeah. And
did they belong to the Salem Church or the Bethlehem?
They went to Bethlehem Church, and she was the grand old lady of Bethlehem. I've got articles and stories about that, which tell about our pioneer mothers, Rora Pioneer Mirdrer, of Mrs. Carolina, telling about her when she passed away. This was before she passed away. I think this article was written, and it gives a lot of information there about the family.
So she organized a mission organization, Missionsföreningen.
Yeah, Missionsföreningen.
So she was active in all her life in the church.
Yeah, she was very, very active in the Bethlehem Church up until she died in, I think it was 1929.
Well, she was 83 years old in May 1929.
Yeah. Here's an article by my mother when she died. No, that's the same thing as.
So you as remember Grandma Wickberg then?
Oh, yes. She We stopped there when we moved from Manchester to Iowa. We spent several days in Brooklyn. We took the boat. Well, first we went to Hartford and visited relatives, Sundmans, who were relatives of my mother. And then we took the boat from Hartford down to New York. I remember that. And then we stayed there a few, maybe about a week. And then I remember that once she came out to Iowa and visited when we lived there. And then in 1929, at Christmas time, I came out to Connecticut to go to Norwich and spend the Christmas vacation there. That's before I was called there. And I stopped in Brooklyn then and saw Grandma. And she was having heart trouble then and was in bed. I remember that. And that's the last I saw her because she died in 1930.
So. Did she speak Swedish to you then?
Oh, yes. She talked Swedish all the time.
Well, she didn't go over to English at any time because
she was too old. At home, we always were taught if we were addressed in Swedish, we should answer in Swedish. And if they talked in English, we should answer in English. And we weren't supposed to mix them up like so many Swedish Americans did.
Was that your father's strict orders or your mother's?
Yeah. Oh, both of them, I guess.
Both of them.
They felt that we should keep the languages separate. But I could tell a little story that I remember when I was a little boy in Iowa. Came home from school one day and there were some visitors there and sitting talking and my father said, I just told him that you can speak Swedish too, so so the man there spoke to me and said, hur mår du? And I answered, all right. And I'd heard afterwards all right about that, that when I was addressed in Swedish, I was supposed to answer in Swedish. But to me, all right sounded good Swedish. Well, anyhow, that's the some of the background of the Krohn and the Wickberg families.
So now about your father, if you go back to that, from being at the Rockford, those grandparents, he started to work, your grandpa started to work in furniture factories.
Yes, he worked in the furniture factory there until he died, I think at 67, of grinder's consumption, as they called it then, from all the dust in the factories.
Did he have trouble with that in the furniture factories?
Yes, of course.
Affected the lungs?
In fact, the record there in the cemetery, in the Scandinavian cemetery in Rockford, they have it, that he died of consumption. That's what they called tuberculosis in those days.
And they meant the lungs were completely... the lungs were affected and...
Yeah, they didn't have vacuum in those days, you see, so there was plenty of dust. A lot of men died from that in those days.
Did some of the people from Rockford, that you know of, go out to the sanatorium in Englewood, Colorado, or in Denver? You haven't heard about that?
Not that I know of. Is there some?
Yeah, there's the Swedish sanatorium in Denver.
Yeah.
I just wonder if some of those workers went out there.
Well, they might have. I don't know.
Well, you haven't heard
anything. I know I've sent a lot of money to that place, and I still do. That Swedish
cemetery. Do you think that it was not the custom? In other words, the workers, he worked until the day was over, and when he had the consumption, that was the end of it. They didn't find any cure for it.
There was no remuneration or anything for.
That was the end of the line.
Yeah, that was to be expected in that kind of work.
And a new immigrant came in and took his place. And a new immigrant came in and took his place.
Well. I never saw Grandpa, of course, because when
you
I was
never saw him. He died.
I was born before. I was born after both my grandfathers died, so I didn't know either of them. And Grandma Krohn, I saw her two or three times. Either she came to, I think she came to Dayton once, and we went to Rockford once when I was about a 11 years old and spent a month there. And
about your uncles or your father's? Hmm? Your father's brothers now and sisters, did they stay on in Rockford? Or
they stayed in Rockford, and the interesting thing is, I could show you pictures I took here last fall when I was up there of a tombstone there that says Crone on one side and Croon on the other, C-R-O-O-N, because my Uncle John kept the pronunciation and changed the spelling, so he went by Croon. And my father and uncle bought this grave lot together, put up a stone in the middle, and put Crone on one side and Croon on the other. And that's where my parents and three brothers are buried. So,
so your father now, he went to Augustana, in other words, he yearned for more learning. Could his father pay for this though, or did your father work his way through Augustana?
He worked his way through, sure.
He worked his way through?
Yeah. I remember one story my father told that my grandfather had been out of work for a while because there was, they laid off some of the workers for some reason, and they came around with an appeal for Augustana College to give him some money. And he said he didn't have any because he wasn't working, but as soon as he started working, he'd give a couple of dollars. And a couple of dollars then was like about $25 or $30 today. And that's what he did. When he, as soon as he got work again, he sent that money because he thought a lot of education, and he sought, and when my father wanted to get college education, he encouraged him to go. So that's, and I don't suppose this.
Did it take more time for him to work his way through, or?
No, he went right through. I'm not sure, but I think he went to what they call the academy first. There's the high school department.
So he was a classmate of Gustav Andrén then?
Well, he might have been. He was ordained, no, he finished in a college in 89, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. 1889. He must have been in the same, but Gustav Andrén didn't go to the theological school though.
No, he didn't go into the seminary, no.
Oh, I mean the seminary.
But my father went back there, as I said, in 94. And then was ordained in 95. And then he got married in October that year.
And then everything was in Swedish?
Everything in Swedish, oh yes.
Mm-hmm. And you got to be a good preacher in both languages.
Then my father started to preach English when we moved to Dayton, Iowa, one Sunday a month when they first came there in 1907. They'd have an English service.
In 1907?
Yeah. He started much earlier than many others did because he saw that the young people weren't learning the Swedish and they wouldn't appreciate the Swedish sermon, so give them English. So he started in, and then after a couple of, well, maybe 3 or 4 years, it was every other Sunday, so half and half. And that's where it was when I was ordained in 1930. I was called to Connecticut because I could preach Swedish. And it was just half and half, every other Sunday.
So you didn't have two sermons then?
No. But I had two sermons every Sunday because I had two churches. And I had to go to two churches every Sunday.
So, was that difficult to do that? I mean, to prepare a Swedish sermon one Sunday and an English one? Did it interfere with your thinking, anything?
No, I don't. It just came naturally because I'd learned enough Swedish, and I took 2 years of Swedish in college, and then, of course, I taught Swedish at Luther College.
Well, there was Swedish teaching?
Yeah, I taught.
Oh, I see. Oh.
Latin and German and Swedish. Mm. I was the language teacher. And I had 2 years of each that I taught there.
And those students not to Luther College, there, were they drawn from Nebraska and Western Iowa?
Yeah, practically all of them
were. South Dakota.
Yeah, practically all of them were from Nebraska. And that was a college that produced more pastors and missionaries than any other Lutheran college in the Augustana Church.
What, more than Augustana?
Yeah, because practically so many of them that went there went into the ministry.
Gustavus and the colleges up there.
Well,
they saw a conference, they liked to be on their own and they didn't want to support Augustana.
Oh, yeah, there was a little of that, but it wasn't.
Quite a bit, wasn't it?
There might have been more in Minnesota than there was.
You didn't feel it in Wahoota, for instance, in Nebraska?
No, they didn't.
For fundraising?
No.
Because you had Nebraska for yourself. And
yeah, they supported Luther College there. And then, of course, they supported the seminary. Originally, it was both college and seminary together. But I forgot what year it was. They separated them so that you could make contributions to either one. So they had separate funds. But of course, 125 years ago when they started the seminary, that was the beginning of Augustana College too.
That's right.
But the emphasis was on the ministry at that time, to prepare men for the ministry.
It has been said that Gustav Andrén, mm-hmm. you know, the president for so many years, he had the vision of making it a university. What would you think about that? Would that have been a good idea?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about making Augustana a university, but...
Was that back in the 20s?
Mm-hmm.
Was that back in the 1920s?
Well, there was talk about it then, but they said they'd have to add some more departments, so they'd have enough departments so it could be called a university. And it was partly a matter of money, I guess. So, but... Andrén did so much to build up Augustana.
Well, you met him personally, I suppose. You met him.
I knew him very well. I could tell you a story about him that when I was 21, while I was at college, it was November and time for election. And I don't remember how it happened now, but I was in the office there. And Pastor or Dr. Andrén was there, and he said something about voting. I said, "Well, I haven't registered to vote here." "Oh," he says, "you're 21, aren't you?" I says, "Yes." "Okay." He got his hat. We walked down the street, down to where the voting booth was. He went up and told him, "This fellow's 21 years old. He can vote." And they said, "Okay," and I voted.
You didn't register even?
No.
And there was
they took his word.
You had to cast a Republican vote, I suppose.
Hmm?
You had to cast a Republican vote, though.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't remember now. But that was a rather interesting experience that he would take time out just to take a person down.
He did things like that. I also heard a story that if some truck came with a load of gravel or something,
yeah,
he went out and took a look at it, you know, where it's supposed to be dumped and everything. He was that kind of a man then.
Oh, yes.
To take interest in details.
Yeah, he was very much that way. You
know? He stayed on there for 34 years.
Was it that long?
1900 to 1934.
Well.
So did he have a great influence on the teachers and the
Well, I think he did. He was a great leader and still not demanding and... domineering.
So he was not pushy then?
No, but he got things done that encouraged others to work too. Oh.
So he made a good go at it.
Well, I don't know what else.
So, yes, well, so your father, he had to travel then from one church to another. And the family had to go with him. And it's always been said, you know, if you change the school for a kids too often.
Oh yeah, we changed schools.
How did you get that feel? In other words, was it good for you to move from one place to another, Galva, Dayton? When you were too young though, when you left, so you can't.
Well, as far as I was concerned, I started school in Straw School in Manchester, New Hampshire. And in those days, they started in February as well as in September, that half year. So I started in February, and then the next year I moved up into the second grade in February. On April 15th, we moved. We got out to Dayton May 15th because we stopped so many relatives and friends in the Niagara Falls and places on the way that it took a month for us to move.
And the school was over when you came to Dayton?
When I came there, it was only 2 weeks left. They moved me up in the third grade. So I was in the second grade about 2 months. So I graduated from high school at 16.
Oh, I see. Did they affect your schooling or anything, or did your father help you with the subject?
No, I got along all right. In fact, there were some of the boys in my class in the fourth grade that didn't pass. They didn't make the grade, and so they had to stay a year behind. Some of my friends were a year behind me, and still they were a year older. But my folks wouldn't let me go to college at 16. I was too young. So I stayed out for 2 years and worked. I worked on farms, and I worked at the Hayes Pump and Planter Company in Galva, because we just moved there while I was at that time. I spent one summer as a tent man for a Chautauqua circuit, going all around in Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and I think I was in Wisconsin too, serving as tent man. That was when I was 17 years old, I went around.
What did it involve, the job?
That involved taking care of the tent, putting up, taking it down, punching the tickets, selling tickets.
It was like a circus.
Yeah, it was like a circus tent, yeah. I learned a lot that year.
You traveled by train or by?
Yeah, all by train, except when it was just a few miles, then we got a drayman, as we called him, to take it. I could sit here for 15 minutes and tell you stories about that summer, what happened. But it was a Chautauqua circuit out of Des Moines, Iowa, Travers Newton. And we'd spend a 5 days or a week in each town, and then have two or three days in between to move the tent to the next town.
Did they have anything to do with Chautauqua here at the?
No, they just took the name. They used the name Chautauqua, and there was Red Pass Chautauqua and this one and two or three others that had these circuits, as they call them, and went around all summer and had programs.
And it was like a private enterprise then?
It was a private, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they could make a living on it?
Yeah. And I forgot what I got a week. It wasn't very much, like $17 a week and travel expenses. I didn't have very much when the summer was over, but I had a few dollars. And so I didn't go to Augustana until I was 18. But I worked, as I said, for Pump and Planter Company there in Galva from September until the middle of November. Armistice Day came along, and they told me, we won't need you anymore because the boys are coming back, and we promised them their job when they came back from the service. So I was out of work. In the meantime, I became 18, so I went up to Cambridge, Illinois, the county seat, and took teacher's exams and passed. And in January, I got a job teaching in a country school.
In Illinois,
right outside of Galva. Because the teacher there had flu, and she had it so bad that the doctor said she couldn't go back and teach until the spring. The kids had been out all November and December because she was sick. I took over in January and taught for 3 months. In those 3 months, I had the kids do 5 months of work, so when she came back, I had, according to the schedule, I had them caught up, and she couldn't get over that I had been able to give them more work and get them to up there. So, and then that summer, I worked on a farm again, and then finally I went to college. And I had $100 in the bank when I went to college. I had saved that much.
So then you enrolled, were you already set to be a pastor then at that time? Or just college? You went into the college then?
Yeah, I went to college, yeah.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. Were your mindset on being a minister?
Oh, no.
No?
No, I went out and taught school for 3 years after I finished college, you know, out at Luther College.
Oh, I see how you went into
that. And, but then, in the meantime, I decided that the Lord wanted me to work in the church, and so I... After 3 years, I went back to Rock Island.
And there you met Birger Svensson.
Hmm?
No, Birger Svensson, you didn't meet him, that was earlier.
Oh yeah, he was there when I was in college. He ran the cafeteria, and I worked in the cafeteria. The first year I was a freshman, I worked in the cafeteria. You know what I did?
No.
Washed cups. They didn't want to put the cups in with the other dishes because the handles would break off too easy. So they had one person wash the cups separate and be very careful with them. And that's what I did, and I got my food for that.
And Berger, he was the manager?
He was the manager of that cafeteria, yeah.
He was through with college then, in other words, he has...
No, he was still in college.
He was still
going to school, but he was managing that on the side. That was his work. Just like I worked. And then the other 3 years I worked in the library at the desk there. And I got enough money for that to pay for my food.
Was they under Skarstedt?
Hmm?
Was they under Skarstedt?
No. Notstein was a librarian then.
He was there then.
The was it Ira Notstein?
Yeah, Ira Notstein, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you were in the new library though, the Denkman.
Yeah, Denkman Library. That was built before I came there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They started that one. So, and then you went on to Sewer Parishes after you went through the theological school.
Yeah, after I was ordained, I went to Connecticut. There 20 years, and then Olean, New York, and then.
So you stayed quite a few years then in each place?
Yeah, either. Anywhere from 7 to 17 years.
Why is it that the pastors nowadays, they only have them 2-3 years, you know, like the Methodists, for instance?
Well,
they keep them only 2-3 years and then they shift them over again to another.
Well, when I grew up, very often Methodist pastors were transferred every year.
Every year?
Yeah. The bishop moved them around, you know. It wasn't what they decided. The bishop told them, you know, this is...
Why was that?
That the Methodists ran it that way, but in our church it was by call. But very often, a man after 2 or 3 years either was having, didn't like the place he was in, or was having some trouble with something. So he would report to the president of the conference that he'd like to move, and he'd find a place for him. But the only times I moved was when I got information that they'd like to have a pastor there, we'd be interested in the call there, and so I'd either go there and look it over, or else they'd call me. Like when I was in Waterbury, I got word from the pastor in Bradford, Pennsylvania, that I'm wondering if I'd be interested in coming to Olean, New York, because he was vice pastor there. And so they called me without even seeing me on his recommendation. Now that very seldom happened.
Ingen provpredikan.
Hmm?
Ingen provpredikan.
No. So at Christmas time, I came out from Connecticut to Olean and spent 3 Sundays there, and decided that, guess that's where the Lord wanted me. But I told him I wouldn't move until in June after school was out. So they had to wait 6 months more before I came. And I was trying to remember the name of the pastor in Bradford. He was a classmate of mine in the seminary. But he's passed away since then.
So wasn't it hard though for both the congregation and the pastor to move so suddenly away after a year like a Methodist?
Well, sometimes it was a little difficult, and other times why it was almost as if, well, he's been here long enough, we want to change. So when I'd been in Olean 17 and a half years, that's the longest I was in one place.
Oh, but then you know the congregation, in other words,
yes.
You know, and they know you.
Yeah, because you stay long enough so you baptize the child and then confirm them. And that they really know the family then. There's an advantage in that, but there's all kinds of things that enter in that bring about the change. It can be some little thing sometimes that influences, and then other times it may be that the pastor has an idea that he wants to get into a bigger church.
Advance.
Yeah, and I never had that feeling. I was at small churches, and I didn't care whether they were small or big. But that was very often the feeling, that if you got called to a big church, that meant that you were more important. But
so, if well, you went to the seminary now, and then they gave you a doctrine to work on, in other words, to what to plant out in the church, and you came out there. Was it easy for you the first few years to reach the congregation and what you told them, they believed what you said? And
well, you felt very immature and felt that you didn't know too much about it, but you went ahead anyhow with the idea because you'd had practice through the years of preaching in various places, you know. But to take full charge, that was just something that you took on and said, well, this is what I got to do. And as you worked, you got to understand more and more what it involved. And I often said there was a dozen different things that a pastor had to be in order to be a pastor.
So when you went through seminary, was there something that you thought should be changed? There's a saying that the pastor is 20 years ahead of the congregation when he comes out of his church from the seminary.
Well, there wasn't anything I felt really needed to change, except we should use more English, and we did.
So you know that the
yeah.
English has to come.
Yeah.
Do you think they changed too late, the Swedish churches?
I would say that it came earlier in the Middle West because of the earlier immigration, whereas in New England, practically everybody there had come from Sweden in the later immigration. And so the churches in New England didn't turn over to English as fast as they did out in the Middle West.
So you had to continue with the Swedish sermon and
I kept, when I left Olean, we had one Swedish service a year, and that was on Fjärrtorsdagen, the day before Good Friday.
Yeah.
Just to keep up the Swedish someplace, I figured. But during those years I was there, we went from, I think it was one Swedish service a month when I came there. And then we kept that on, and then we cut it to No, I think it was 2 Swedish service a month. Then we cut it down after a few years to 1 Swedish service a month. And then we cut it down to 2 or 3 times a year, maybe. And then finally, when I left there, it was just the last few years, it was just a token service for the benefit of those that would like to hear a little Swedish.
Old-timers. And it was in what year, 1960?
This was 1950.
Well, 1950?
Yeah. And when I came to Åland, it was all English.
All English?
Yeah.
So you, Lutherna, did they ask for the congregation, the old-timers and also the young ones?
Well, that's the point, that the young people began to ask for it, and then, of course, if they didn't get English, they'd go to other churches. Mm-hmm. So it was only the pastor just had to give in, and even if he didn't want to, he had to change the English. And there were, I know there are some cases where pastors went back to Sweden because they didn't want to preach English.
That's right. How was it during the war now? You said you worked in Galva during the Armistice Day, you said you were told to.
Yeah.
But your father, wasn't he Dayton, Iowa before?
He was what?
In Dayton, Iowa.
Yeah.
Was he there when Governor Hollers declared no foreign language to be spoken in the churches? Was there after he left?
Well, it was, I think, when we were still in Iowa that we had to, the sentiment was that, well, don't use foreign languages after all. That was during World War I, that's very special. And especially not German, that was taboo.
That was all.
Yeah. And the result was that although I learned quite a bit of Swedish, my brother, who is 12 years younger, knows very little Swedish. Because he grew up in those days when we just quit talking Swedish at home, we just talked English because it wasn't.
So he understood Swedish, but he didn't want to answer back in.
Well, he can speak a little bit, but not like I can. And yet he can read a little bit, but it's quite a difference. And those are the transition years.
So, but they said that there were some pastors that had to leave Iowa because they didn't want to move away from the Swedish. They moved up to Minnesota and.
Well, maybe they kept Swedish in Minnesota, but as I said, in the Middle West, generally they changed.
Earlier than
they did in New England.
How about did you notice when the old timers died? Or I mean, when they were sick, did they want to hear some Swedish? Prayers or...
Oh yes, if they were, they'd prefer to have Bible reading and prayer in Swedish. Mm-hmm.
So which one was the most favorite for them to hear? In other words, what did you read?
Well, if they were born in Sweden and brought up there especially, then they wanted Swedish. But of course, if they were born and brought up here, English was so... They didn't ask for Swedish.
Was there some special prayer they asked for when you made house calls or hospital calls? Was there some special prayer they asked more for than others?
Well, once in a while they might ask for Swedish, but most of the time it was English.
It was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at the funerals were usually a Swedish sung then?
Yeah, sometimes might have just a few words in Swedish, then the rest in English. But it would vary in different people and different, as the years went by, of course, just a gradual change.
Change order. So during the Depression, did you serve any congregation during the Depression? Or, yeah, you came out in the 90s?
Yeah, I was in...
Connecticut?
Yeah, I was in Connecticut then.
How was the hard times out there then for the pastor? Low pay and...
Oh, very low pay is right. I got $1,800 when I came to Connecticut. And then in 1937, I was called to Waterbury for $1,600.
So there was a drop?
But the understanding was that I would also serve the church in Thomaston, and I'd get a little money there, so I figured that would be about the same, maybe a little more. But the pay has always stayed very low all through the years, because I owed about $1,000 when I finished college, and I paid that back when I taught. And then when I got through seminary, I bought a car, and so I owed over $1,000. I never did get out of debt. All my whole ministry, I was always in debt.
It was just rolling over.
And owed some. I borrowed my insurance, for instance, and then I put off paying bills because I didn't have the money. Put it off a month or two.
So there was tough times.
And then, but even when they got better, but then when I retired with Medicare, I mean with Social Security and part-time work, I made as much money as when I worked full-time. So I was able to pay up my debts after I retired. I got free of debts.
That is interesting. Yeah, but you paid into the pension fund though in the 30s.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I talked to Pastor Sayers. You know August Sayers? He was a pastor out in Michigan. A short fellow.
Who?
Sayers.
Oh.
Now, you remember him?
Yeah.
Because he died very, very old, 1944, I believe. He was up in the 90s.
Yeah.
And he always, I talked to his daughter, you know, in the 1970s. And she said that her dad was so mad because every time an Augustana Lutheran pastor died, he has to pay in $1.
Yeah.
But he said, when they're going to pay in to me, he said, I will never get it because I will be dead then, he said.
Oh.
So what kind of system was it really? In other words, as soon as somebody died of the pastors, you had to pay in.
Oh, that was before my time. They changed that.
They changed that?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have to
because
do that.
Because it was for the survivors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, but it took a long time though before the Augustana pastors got a good pension fund.
Yeah, but it's very good now. And because between the pension and the Social Security, I get a poverty income, $10,000.
Uh-huh. So, well, you got Medicaid then, and
now I get Medicare, you see, so Medicare. That.
So there, when the merger occurred, and they started already in the 1950s, talking about we're going to merge with other churches, like Missouri Lutheran mm-hmm. Church was going together, and the Germans, and the Finnish, and the Danish. What was the consent then among the Augustana Lutheran pastors, you think?
Well, I think...
Were they all for it?
Well, the majority were for it, because that's what they voted.
I know, but do you think the members at large were for it? Or did they understand what it actually was?
Well, to most of them, it didn't make much difference. I figured they'd go on, church would go on as it was anyhow, with the same pastor, and especially those that weren't involved in any activities outside the local congregation. They just
figured
it didn't make much difference whether they belonged to this or that.
But for the pastors, it made a difference, though.
Yeah, the pastors.
Because you get a better pension fund.
Well, I was at the meeting out in Seattle, Washington, when they voted. I voted against the merger.
On what grounds? On what grounds?
Because I felt we weren't ready for it, and we would be swallowed up. And we were.
Were there many against it?
Well, there were a great many, but not a majority, you see. The majority were for it. And especially the president of the church, he was very much for it. But Oscar Benson, but I think later on he wished they'd waited a while. Because I think that...
Bergendorf, was he for it?
Hmm?
Bergendorf, was he for it?
I suppose he was, I don't know. But now we're finally getting together with the others in 2008. two or three years now. But I think we'd been better off if we'd gone in with the Norwegians than with the Germans. Yeah. That is. But the Norwegians went in with some other Germans, and so. But they were. They weren't swallowed up so much as we were, because it wasn't such a predominance of the others.
You see now, like the Evangelical Covenant Church. I mean, they were much, much smaller.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they are still going.
Yeah.
On their own.
Sure. Well, you see, they have no other group that has the same name, and the feeling that they are a part of that there. Whereas we were always that feel, we were Lutherans, and there were other Lutheran churches, and the feeling, well, why shouldn't we all be together if we're all Lutherans? And that was the sentiment that kept being presented again and again. After all, if we're Lutheran, let's get together.
Who was the biggest spokesman for that movement, you think, to unite?
Well, I don't know, except Oscar Benson, the president. He was always for it, and of course there were quite a few others that felt it was the thing to do.
But the Missouri Lutherans, they didn't...
No, they didn't, and they aren't going in now either. They're separate.
Are those a strong church body, you think, the Missouri Lutherans? Are they strong, actually, in the spirit, I suppose? They are strong, but how about the...